It's time for Mac Break Weekly. We've got a great show for you. Alex Lindsay's here, Andy Iannocco, Lori Gill filling in for Renee Ritchie. We're going to talk about the new updates for iOS and the Apple Watch, which have turned on ECG. They think it's the best thing since sliced bread. I have a little more worries. The final results are in over the Supermicro Bloomberg story. Uh-oh. You got some splaining to do. And why the iPhone XR might be the best phone for you. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 640, recorded Tuesday, December 11th, 2018. Fruit Company adjacent. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Gazelle, the online marketplace for buying and selling used devices. Shop from a variety of certified pre-owned electronics or trade one in for cash. Give new life to a used device at gazelle.com today. And by privacy.com. Stop using the same card number everywhere. Use Privacy virtual cards and get a $5 credit off your first purchase. Learn more and sign up in under a minute with your debit or checking account at privacy.com/MacBreak. And by LastPass, secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 43,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest Apple news. The festive version. I'm wearing blinky lights because it's, well, we're getting close to the holidays. It's December 11th. Joining us, it's interesting, Renee Ritchie is not here. He was called away suddenly. Lori Gill is great to have, the managing editor of iMore. I always love having Lori on.
Thanks for having me.
And maybe you know, when Renee Ritchie is called away suddenly, usually that's for a briefing from the fruit company.
It's not. Okay. I can definitely tell you that.
Oh, good.
It's business. It's tangentially related.
Tangentially related.
But not direct from the fruit company.
I see. It's a fruit company supplier. Okay. Anyway.
It's fruit companies adjacent.
Adjacent. A fruit adjacent company. Well, whatever the reason, thrilled to have you on, Lori. Thank you.
I love it when he has to go off and do things because I get to join you.
So do we.
Yay.
Andy Iannocco's also here from the beautiful WGBH in Boston, Boston Public Radio, and Iannocco.com. Hello, Andrew.
Hello. And yes, I actually had this thought a couple yesterday when I'm on my Instagram and I see that there's another picture of Renee's watch of a flight that involves going to New York. And my first
thought had the same thought, right?
My first thought was, who is he meeting with and is it Apple related?
Yep.
And the second thought was, do we get to have Lori on the show on
thought. Oh, that's great.
Everybody's happy about that. That's awesome.
I feel so special.
Also from the nation's capital, home of the smocking gun, Alex Lindsay of the Pixel Corps. And it looks like you're in a beautiful winter wonderland today.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get into the mood, you know, so I'm not known for being a Christmas person. So every week I'm trying to find some new Christmassy kind of feel.
So you're providing the background, not us.
That's correct.
I believe that's the case because it's nicely out of focus. There's like a depth of field thing going on. I don't think we can actually do that, so.
The key is a little clearer, you know.
Yeah, it's a magical thing. Your hair is like actually not green. It's pretty impressive, actually, what you're able to do.
Yep.
Yeah, can you come over to my house and make my background look like that?
I know. Isn't that awesome?
That's real pretty.
Isn't that great? I don't know if there's a whole lot of news, a whole lot of shaking going on, because as we get closer to the holidays, things get quieter and quieter, but I guess, let's see, there are new versions of the software out there. iOS 12.1.1 came out. I downloaded it. eSIM support, so you can now have the dual SIMs, promised us. Notification preview using haptic touch on iPhone XR. One tap to flip between the rear and front facing camera during a FaceTime call. Live photo capture during one-to-one FaceTime calls. The options to hide the sidebar in news on iPad. Real-time text when using Wi-Fi calling on iPad and iPod Touch. Stability improvements. I imagine there are a few bug fixes and security fixes. The biggest thing you'll notice, ECG is now enabled if you have an Apple Watch.
Yeah.
So you now the trick is don't go to the Watch app. That's where I went. Where's the ECG? Go to the Health app, and you'll get a banner right away that says, hey, you got ECG. And you can then set it up on your Apple Watch. They warn you again and again. If you're having a heart attack, this doesn't diagnose that. If you're having a stroke, this doesn't diagnose that. Go to your doctor. Get help. Don't be taking an ECG because you're feeling poorly. But for it's for people with AFib and then like, right?
But actually, if you are feeling poorly, maybe you should anyway. Because almost as soon as it went live, there were at least anecdotal reports, people on Reddit saying, my favorite one was, I think it was on day one, where someone like, oh, wow, I want to try this new ECG feature. And says, so it says I'm an AFib. Okay, we'll try it again. Maybe I got too much sweat. Says, damn it, it's broken. It doesn't work correctly. Here, honey, put on this watch and see if you, and nope, my wife seems to get like normal sinus rhythm. Like, maybe I should check with my doctor. And the doctor said, yep, you are in AFib. and it's good that you came in today. Not that saved the person's life, but that this is it was an AFib situation that now they can monitor. Yeah. That's a really cool anecdotal story, and they're coming in by the dozens. However, that said, I have to go back to what I was looking into when this feature was first announced, that there have been 2-year studies of people with medical grade, like prescription grade body ECG monitors, and they were not able to find any sort of link between the people with AFib who are wearing a daily monitor and people who are not wearing the daily monitor, that it managed to prevent heart attack or prevent stroke or prevent any of the things you're hoping to get. This is still, and also it went through, it was approved by the FDA under a special let's get new technology through as fast as possible thing. So it hasn't been tested as much as let's say a drug has. And it's also the reason why you can't get it in Canada, because the Canadian equivalent of the FDA hasn't approved it yet. So, but still very, very interesting if it makes people more aware of their health and it gives them something active to do. And if what these people are saying that their doctors told them, it's good that you came in, you were an AFib, and now they have a situation they can actually monitor. Good.
Andy, I think you've got something specific. You said that it makes us more aware of our health, and I think that's what this ECG monitor is, the benefit of it. Just like you're saying, there's no evidence that it would be more beneficial than just, you know, going to your doctor. But I think there might be a lot of people out there who they might be sitting around thinking, I think that there's something wrong with my heart. And then they use this ECG monitor and it comes up as not AFib. I think that could maybe like calm some fears about whether or not you have something wrong with your heart, instead of constantly going to the doctor because your heart paced randomly for no reason. You can kind of test that on your Apple Watch and kind of think, so is there anything wrong with me? No, your heart rate is up, but other than that, you're okay. I think in general, you're right that it's a good thing to have to make us all aware. For everyone who wears an Apple Watch, you don't have to get a special medical equipment from your doctor that you have to wear around on you all the time. It's just this thing that you already use with everything else that you do in life, and you can kind of use it to help you just be aware of your heart.
Yeah, I think a lot of times we say internally that, you know, you don't measure what matters. What you measure becomes what matters. You know? And so I think that what's interesting about the watch is that you're constantly, you know, I find myself paying a lot more attention to how much I'm walking, how much I'm active, how many calories I'm burning. And now I have this little toy called, you know, the ECG. You know, I see it as a toy, but I like doing it. You know, it's a fun, it's a fun little graph. And, you know, maybe that'll bring something up. I think that one of the things that's really interesting is that we are massively increasing the sample rate. So while we haven't seen a lot of correlation in the past, we may see a different set of correlations when we increase a sample rate from hundreds or thousands to millions. We may see, and even if it makes a difference for a handful of people, it was worth it. And it's a really cool little, if you haven't done it yet, if you have the watch, it's just fun to watch it.
Okay, I'm going to now poo-poo everything you all just said. You're wrong. It's actually very dangerous to once again, it is not a good idea if you're having a heart attack to check your Apple Watch. There is direct correlation between...
I think you're misunderstanding.
Hold on, let me finish. No, I'm not. Let me finish. Let me also point you to this article on Medium. I'm a heart doctor. Here's why I'm wary of the new Apple Watch. Screening for atrial fibrillation in healthy people just doesn't make sense. There's also the larger... You're going to see all these stories, and Apple's going to pump this up, that it's saving lives. What it doesn't tell you is the person who died because he was having a heart attack and then went to his watch... because he didn't post it on Reddit. If you're having a heart attack or a stroke, this is no benefit at all, A, and you should not check your freaking watch. And so the Apple says this over and over. This doesn't diagnose heart attacks and stroke. This does, but people are still going to do it. The second issue, and this is the issue John Mandrola raises, and he raised this. This came out in September. We talked about it then, but I just want to reiterate it. That the problem, he says, as a heart doctor, my opinion is, if you think an Apple Watch is nifty, buy one, but do not buy it for your health. It will not improve your health, and it could bring you harm. In particular, the problem is that even with a 12-lead electrocardiogram, there are significant, about 10% false positives. So that means 10% of the people with real ECGs are going to either think they're sick or get treatment for sickness, which they shouldn't get, which is actually dangerous. This is going to cause a lot of people saying, oh, I'm running to the doctor, because it's not a 12 lead. It's a 2 lead, which is less accurate. I think where this is indicated for, and there is a great product from AliveCor called Cardia that does exactly the same thing, a 2 lead ECG that ties to your iPhone. If you have already been diagnosed with AFib, this makes a lot of sense. So does the Cardia, because that'll give your doctor additional data points. The risk is a lot of people will increase anxiety, and some people may, in fact, try to treat a heart attack or a stroke and die because instead of seeking real treatment, they thought the Apple Watch was going to help them. I think it's really important. I think Apple's overselling this. I think it's really important to understand the value, the limited value of it, and the risk. And I think it's very common. Doctors say this all the time. These, you know, there's full body scans and stuff out there. And the risk is that people healthy people are getting tested. When you endeavor to make healthy people healthier, he says, you always risk making them worse. Not 100%. Many people get benefit. Probably nobody on this panel will get any problem from this. It's just, please don't think this is medical grade anything.
And you're right about that. There is a risk involved in sort of implying that this is somehow beneficial when it's to healthy people. It's not. It's nothing to people that are healthy.
And it has the risk of people getting freaked out. And, you know, if you're a hypochondriac, you're going to be measuring your heart rate all the time.
And if you're somebody who's like active in the Apple tech world, you know the difference between the two. But the average consumer doesn't necessarily. And if we're presenting too much positive information about this particular feature, and then just an average person who doesn't really know much about it goes out and buys an Apple Watch specifically thinking that it's going to save their life if they have a heart attack, then it was, you know, our job as the tech writers, for example, to make that clear. And if we're not careful, we're not making that clear enough. So you're definitely right about that. It could lead to misinformation, and the general public needs a lot more information about what it can and can't do instead of just like, isn't this great?
And I'm not a doctor. I'm not pretending to be. I just want to pass along this from a heart doctor. Sending hundreds of thousands of wrongly diagnosed people to the doctor scares me, he says. In addition to needless anxiety and costs, this is hazardous. Because while some doctors will simply reassure the patient, many other doctors will order tests. Since all medical interventions come with risks, many people will suffer harm from unnecessary tests and procedures. Just something to keep in mind.
Yeah, that's definitely true. One of the weird things about medicine from the consumer point of view is that doctors continue to insist that they can't treat healthy people for a problem. That when a problem manifests itself, when someone actually starts to have symptoms of something, then you can actually use that data to figure out that something's wrong with them. But you can't really tell someone that it's not useful to say my watch says I'm an AFib, but I feel fine. That's not useful. And that's just more data that'll cluttering an analysis, and also, as that other doctor said, kind of force them to put someone through a battery of tests that they might not need, and causing more expense and also more load on a stressed out medical system. The only thing is so it is important to keep stressing, especially again, that the fact that you've got an even when you're in a controlled study, even when you've been diagnosed with AFib, the fact that you have a sensor with you is not did not prove that someone had a better better treatment and better better safety because they were being monitored. However, I think that on the whole, it's important for the most important tool that we have as arbiters of our own health is a knowledge of what normal is. That I feel right now, I'm alert, I'm awake, I don't feel any pain anywhere, I'm not aware of the beating of my heart, although I'm aware that it's certainly doing something. My speech does not seem slurred, I'm not stuttering, I'm not stumbling, and so I feel as though I'm pretty healthy right now. So I know that this is sort of normal for me. If, let's say, tomorrow I notice that I can no longer, I'm having problems getting toothpaste on my toothbrush because my fingers don't want to clasp anymore, or if I climbed a flight of stairs and I'm normally not out of breath, but now I'm out of breath, that's not normal. That means that's a suggestion that I should either keep an eye on this or, at worst, get medical help. Again, speaking broadly, when you have diagnostic tools like this, maybe you will just take a sensor reading just to see what's going on, and you know that, okay, this seems normal. This is the normal for me. But when my watch is telling me that my heartbeat is at 140 beats per minute, and I've just been like cooking a roast. I haven't been eating any drugs. I haven't been working out. That's not normal. And after a half hour, when I see that it's not slowly going down, it's actually steadily maintaining, that's another indication that this is not normal. Perhaps I should do something. So that's the role of consumer medical stuff. It needs to be really, really carefully regulated. It needs to be explained also really, really carefully. But the big goal should always be to help this person have better awareness of what is normal for them and when something is suddenly abnormal.
Yeah, the difference between this and the cardia is something that if you've already had diagnosis of AFib, like Jeff Jarvis of This Week in Google has had, he thinks that's a really great thing because if he, you know, the AFib is sometimes symptomless. I suppose, you know, there will be more and more stories about people whose lives were saved by the Apple Watch. That's all great. But it's just... I think we need to be cautious, and it's our job not to be part of the Apple hype machine, but to say, hey, this doesn't treat a heart attack. This doesn't treat a stroke. If you have other symptoms, you should consult your doctor. If you think you have AFib, you should consult your doctor and not trust the watch to do the diagnosis. Go get a real ECG. It's important to get to the hospital if you've got arterial fibrillation. But
I get heart rate warnings every time I watch a Steeler game.
Yeah. I think people understand that the heart rate, high heart rate warning and the low heart rate warning, understand what that is. The ECG sounds more medical.
Yeah. It makes a great graph, though. Like, if you're a graphic artist and you want
it. Makes great stories on tech blogs. And so you're going to see all the people whose lives were saved. But that's only part of the story, I guess. I don't know. If you're my age, you should probably ask your doctor before trusting it. Atrial fibrillation. Thank you, Bramster.
I can never say that.
AFib is easier to say.
Fibrillation.
Fibrillation.
Yeah, atrial is much easier to say. Yeah. Before you change subjects about the update, I do want to point out one tiny little update that I think went completely unnoticed. When iOS 12 first launched, Apple removed live photos from FaceTime.
Right.
It's back. That's one of the live photo capture during one-to-one FaceTime calls. So you can't do it in group calls, which I'm not sure how you could do it in group calls anyway. So one-to-one FaceTime, you have live photos back. So I just wanted to point that out for anybody who liked that feature. It's back.
Well, and there was a feature I used all the time, which was the double tap to flip it around. Because I'm talking to my mom, and I want to show her the Christmas tree, and you have to go into the settings. Now you can – that double tap is back, too, and that was very useful. They took that out, too. I'm not sure what happened.
It's probably just like a update design. Let's get it out later.
Right. So maybe they rewrote. I don't know. Yeah, and I don't want to be too negative, and but I just know that I can't be too negative because there will be tons of stories like this Reddit story of people whose lives were saved. His doctor said, you should buy Apple stock because I think they saved your life.
Oh, yeah, no,
you're going to see those.
That's bus ad sort of material, and that's when...
Yeah.
I will say I'm glad you're wearing the flashing lights because that did take like sort of the dark edge off of this conversation.
Of all of you, I'm the one most likely to have AFib, a stroke, a heart attack, probably during the show. So, but I did
check your Apple Watch.
I did, and I am in normal sinus rhythm, so I'm okay. So,
do you have those lights like hook up to your like your pulse rate?
That's
monitor?
What it should be, right? That is my pulse rate. Are you worried now? For those listening, I'm wearing a listener sent us these, and I wore them for iOS today, and I couldn't take them off. It's a lovely Statue of Liberty style tiara
of old-timey Christmas colored Christmas bulbs
that are
powered
blinking
by flashing LEDs.
Although apparently they have various rhythms. If you're epileptic, I apologize for what I'm about to do. There you go. That's the fast flash. I kind of like the slow blinking. And then I also have a necklace of the same. But, you know, I think these are LEDs, Andy. I think the...
Yeah,
they just look like the old school lights.
Yeah. No, but in the 90s, I built like a ring of like holiday lights for my hat. And I wanted them to be actually visible, like in when there's lights on in the room. And the only way to do that was with like 12 volt turn signal bulbs
and a giant battery pack in your pocket, right?
Because you're not joking. I programmed like a PIC controller in the crown of my hat so that they could flash through. And then there was literally like a little like lead acid motorcycle battery in a bag that. Because it was a way to like go to Christmas parties and people would ask about the hat and I would have to talk about myself.
Aww.
It was a very nerd solution. Maybe they will ask me about technology as opposed to, so that's quite a look you've got going with the pants and the shoes and that jacket.
I got to show you the jacket, Megan. We did our iOS Today gift guide. Earlier today, you can see it on our iOS Today show, and Megan had a jacket with LED filaments, fiber optic filaments in the jacket that was stunning.
Yeah,
it's gorgeous. And $350.
Adafruit will get you styling real quick.
It's amazing what we can do now.
Get a Gemma controller, download a sketch, and boy, will you look super cool.
3D print your clothing from now on. Our show today, we're going to take a little break, come back with lots more news. But first, a word from Gazelle. I know you're eyeing for the holidays maybe a new iPhone, a new tablet. Gazelle is the place to trade in your old devices, get some cash to subsidize your new devices. This is really the solution for people like me who always want the latest and greatest. You just sell the old one. We periodically, right about this time, we gather all the old iPhones from our staff, Megan and Jason, all the old phones. We sell them on Gazelle because they got all new phones for the holidays, you know. You could do the same thing. And they give you a great price. You'll instantly find out what your device is worth. You get, quote, right away guaranteed for 30 days. Shipping's free. Payment's fast. I like the 30 days because it means you have time to transfer the old data over. They are not just iPhones and iPads. They also accept Samsung Galaxy S9s. Older iPhones, too, like the iPhone 8, the iPhone 10. Now, what happens to all that stuff? Well, they take the very best stuff they get, and they certify it, and they sell it. So this is also, Gazelle is a great place to get an incredible selection of quality, certified, pre-owned devices at great prices. Going back to the iPhone 6 through 10, my mom refuses to have a modern iPhone. She will only have an iPhone 6S because she needs the headphone jack. So it's a great place to get the last headphone jacks iPhones. For iPads, check out their standard Air Mini and Pro models. For laptops, you get the MacBook Air and the Pro selection. They even cater to Android users with a variety of Samsung Galaxy phones. See, there's always somebody who's ready to get the next thing, and I think most of us are willing to have the older thing and save big. Here's the nice part. Every device is fully inspected and backed by a 30-day return policy. All of them work on the major carriers in the U.S., but none of them have a carrier contract. Gazelle also will give you financing, which makes it really easy to buy. On checkout, you can say, I want financing with a firm. Some basic information, you'll get instantly approved. You can pay off in 3, 6, or 12 months. through bank transfer, check, or debit card. All you got to do at checkout, check that box, financing with Affirm. It's very easy. Gazelle, we love it. GAZELLE.com. Give new life to used devices. Trade them in for cash or buy a certified pre-owned device. It's good for the environment. It's good for your pocketbook. Visit Gazelle.com today to get started. This is the Gazelle season. GAZELLE.com. I like the iPhone XR. And you know what? There's some good news about the XR. One of the things you, there are two things you give up. XR, which is nice about the XR, $750 starting price, so it's a lot less than a XS. Size, I think, is kind of the sweet spot in between the 10, 10S, and 10S Max, kind of in between. But you have an LCD screen, not an OLED screen. It doesn't bother me. That's a great screen. And you only get one lens. Well, the tests are in, and it's the best single-lens phone yet. In fact, even beats the Pixel 2 in single-camera benchmarks. This is from DxOMark, which often does you know, these tests, and they gave it a very good score, which is very encouraging. The iPhone XR offers comparable quality photos to the XS Max. In fact, DxOMark said it's a better flash. The only thing you miss is the zoom, the optical zoom with a dual lens, and some bokeh effects you get with the portrait mode, because in some cases it uses the dual lens. It works well, according to DxOMark, with a human subject, but it doesn't work well with something other than a face. Well, okay. They rated the phone very good for indoor and outdoor shots. Not as great for low-light conditions, but that's a problem most phones, except for these new Pixels, are prone to. It also has excellent autofocus, according to DxOMark, with fast response times and no focus stability issues. So if I honestly think I have a XR, I really like it. And I think people who want to save money and maybe were worried that, oh, the camera's, because it's got A12 Bionic in there. It's the new platform. It's just got that LCD screen. Looks great. And it's got a single lens, which works, according to DxOMark, very well. In some cases, better than the XS Max.
Yeah, and even better than.
I think.
Go ahead, Andy.
And even better. It scored even higher than the iPhone X last year. So that's just
pretty
very,
darn
very
good.
It's true. I wish that they had tests for the new Pixel 3, which is also a single lens camera, phone camera. But the fact it really is reassuring to know that Apple didn't cheap out on anything. They really tried to make the best camera, the best screen, the best everything they could, while still getting the price down back to the level of a non like super, super premium price phone.
Yes, Lori.
I was going to mention that. When my friends ask me which iPhone should I get, because, you know, right now you can get a 7, 8, 10, 10R, 10S. Yeah, like there's so many now that are just straight from Apple, the current line. And I always recommend the 10R because it's the perfect in-between. There are a couple of people out there who I think would benefit from a 10S or 10S Max when it comes to the camera. But screen quality, no. I think the difference between them two for most of us is not even recognizable. Yeah. But with the camera, most people are going to be very happy with the XR camera. So I definitely believe that the XR is the perfect in between.
From getting an 8 or a 7, because why not get the late? I mean, you save a little more, but although I have to say with trade-ins, the iPhone XR is very affordable right now.
It really is the new CPU that is the star
you
of that.
You want the A12. I really think so. That gives you future proofing.
Exactly.
I think the only reason I like the S is because I use the Zoom a lot, you know, like all the time.
Yeah, Lisa so does too. And she reason. Says I would have to have the Zoom. So if you know that, if you're always tapping that 2X button, then maybe you want it.
There are people out there that you definitely would say you need the XS or XS Max, but that's not most of us. Most of us don't need that Zoom.
I agree. Yeah, I agree.
I have to say, in software, Apple will, you know, I look at the Pixel 3 XL, which is also a single lens camera, but the zoom on this is mind-boggling because of the computational photography they're doing with it. And I wonder how long before Apple does something similar in software that makes up for the lack of a physical lens.
Yeah, it's totally possible. The other slightly not awesome issue, but for most people, it's not an issue, is that the bokeh effect is only available for faces. So their depth effect, it won't recognize an object, a cat, your food. It won't give you that effect. It will only do that if you have a face. Most of us are not going to use portrait mode to do anything but take pictures of ourselves. But there are, you know, some Instagrammers out there who I think would be disappointed to discover that they're, you know, if they want to take portrait mode pictures of, you know, their cute cups or their cute shoes, that they don't get to do that with the 10R. So.
Yeah. And what Lori's saying is super interesting too, because remember that the whole point of that, of those modes is to sort of computationally fake having a different lens altogether. And now we're noting that one of the things you lose by getting the less expensive single lens camera is that you don't get you can't fake that fake lens as well as you can with just the single. And I think that the real big leaps for the next couple of years certainly are going to be in the computational end of things. Like before the show, Leo and I were talking about the night sight feature on our Android cameras and how we can take, speaking for myself, I can take pictures walking at 1 a.m. From Lincoln Center to Penn Station in New York that would be absolutely pointless to even try to take with my iPhone or with any other camera that didn't have this feature. And what you really appreciate isn't necessarily that if I zoom on this daylight picture of this building, there's better color and less noise if the more I zoom and the more I check it out. The thing you appreciate is that I can take a picture I couldn't take before. I can take a picture that I would have associated with having a $1,000 pocket camera or a $1,000 SLR. And that's what portrait mode does, and that's what night sight does. And that's what we're going to see in the next couple of years. We're going to see Apple get much better at low light stuff, not by getting a new sensor, but by, again, doing more cooking of the image. And we're going to see the Google phones, which are still, they don't have a single dual lens Pixel phone in the lineup. We're going to see them get better at doing that fake bokeh effect and try to figure out how to do it with just one lens and just by jiggling around the optical image stabilizer.
This is a picture I took with a Pixel 3 in Times Square. It's an HDR picture. It's kind of remarkable.
Yeah.
What you can do. I mean, it just blows me away. Here's an example of the zoom. I was standing on the street outside the Lyric Theater before we saw Harry Potter, and I zoomed in on, see this thing up in the right corner, the nest with the wings. I zoomed in on it, and I have to say the detail, it's a little bit softer, but
yeah,
that's first of all a much bigger zoom than you'd get with the iPhone. That's zooming by pinching. It's a completely digital zoom, and yet because of computational photography, I think it does a remarkable job. It's not, look, if I had my 5D Mark IV and a 200 millimeter lens, I'd do a better job, but I didn't.
Yeah, it's I have to unlearn so much. I used to say, I've turned off all the digital zoom features on my phones because all it does is make the pixels bigger.
But I always laughed at people. See them pinching in, thinking you're going to hate that shot. And
yep. But whether it's on the iPhone, the Google phone, a Samsung phone, it does it so well that I can't really tell when I go through my film loop how many of these pictures were at the natural resolution and some were digitally zoomed.
These are the things that, you know, people with professional cameras said, well, you can't use a camera phone to zoom. You can't use a camera phone in low light. That's changing. Alex, you're as serious a photographer as anybody. I'm sure you still
use most of my photos. I take the vast majority of my photos on my iPhone.
Interesting.
it's the thing I have that I'm carrying around, and right. So I definitely have an SLR. I have a Canon, and I definitely shoot it. When I take pictures with it, it is like, okay, well, this is a much better camera. I mean, you definitely. It's not like I forget that if I want to take great photos that I'm going to print of my kids, oftentimes, or my wife, I'm going to take it with my Canon, but there are many photos that I have printed on the walls and all kinds of other things that are all shot with my iPhone at this point. And so it's kind of amazing. I think that the only two things I really carry around are my iPhone and I have one of the red, you know, stereo cameras, and I like taking stereo pictures. So I take lots of stereo photos.
You're using that, huh?
I use it. I've been shooting stereo photos for a decade. So, you know, the Fuji had had a camera before this, and then I had adapters before that. And so it's just a, I don't look at it as a phone. I mean, it's nice that it has Android and everything else, but if it came out as a camera, that's all I'd use it for. Cause I just, I find the process to be entertaining. So I just do it just for fun.
There was, do you remember, Carsten, where that was? There was an article that said Apple and other companies are going to have a problem because we have reached not merely plateau, but really the beginning of the end, the decline of phones. There it is. This is from the New York Magazine Intelligencer. We're no longer in smartphone plateau. We're in smartphone decline. And what he's pointing out is not only is it hard to find a feature in a new phone that will make people say, oh, this is much better. I mean, in the between 2007, when the iPhone first came out, and say 2012, there were massive improvements consistently, year after year, and there really was an incentive to buy. He says now people really are sticking. We've got people in the chat room saying, look at this. They're sticking with their old phone. We've got people in the chat room saying, you know, that SE is still pretty good. You know, why would you buy anything more than an iPhone 7? And, you know, despite all what we're saying, normal people are not seeing the benefit of upgrading. We're kind of in a point now where people are repairing rather than replacing. He likens it to the car industry, where it just made sense for people to repair their car, not to buy a new car. And I'm not sure I completely disagree with that. I think it's going to be a challenge. Apple already knows this. One of Apple's solutions is to increase the cost of the phone. So to make up for a fall in unit sales by an increase in revenue by, you know, increasing the cost. But that's going to backfire in the long run, as people are going to say, well, boy, I'm not I don't want to buy a phone that's over $1,000.
Yeah. I do think that we'll probably see a super cycle in 3 or 4 years. Right now, 5G, I don't think is a big deal, but we've had the opportunity to work on some tests, and we think that 5G is going to be a big deal in 3 or 4 years, but it'll take that long, and then everyone's going to want to upgrade to get.
Well, what will that feature be, do you think?
Well, I think that there's going to be a lot of things you can do with your phone at venues and at just walking around the street. The low latency opens up a lot of possibilities. Right now, we can't do a lot of things with the phones because it's not so much the bandwidth, but the latency is really long. So it's way behind all the time. And that latency is going to go away, mostly in urban areas. And again, in areas where there's a high concentration of venues or a high concentration of traffic where they end up supporting those things. I think that that's going to happen. Also, I think that, we are going to get to a point where in 3 to 5 years, we have 5G getting rid of Wi-Fi, like at home. You're not going to, Comcast is going to come through and say you don't need a router. You're just going to be on 5G. And then what happens is you're not jumping from Wi-Fi to Wi-Fi. You're just on 5G. When you leave, when you're there, for the folks in the city, it'll stay on 5G. For the folks in the country, you'll be in 5G in certain areas, So it'll
5G
be
5G will it'll be all a big depend. Deal. Yeah. Apple it'll says, be, according people, to the Ming-Chi Kuo, Apple's not going to do 5G at least for 2 more years.
Which I think makes sense. I don't think there's any good reason to do that. I think that it's going to take a long time for this rollout to happen, and it is a little bit of a chicken or egg thing because you can't get people to upgrade their phones that support 5G until there's enough places to do it. And Verizon is kind of using a non-standard, screwy 5G because they want to be out there first. But there's a good argument for doing that so that you can get people thinking about it.
But back to your original point. I mean, I still have my Pixel 1, which I bought when it was already out for a year because I got a good deal in it. I kind of planned on getting a new phone this year because, hey, it's been 2 years. I'm kind of due. But I'll be honest and say that the improvements that Google has made for the phone in terms of the camera haven't kind of whetted my appetite for. It feels like I've got enough of a new phone right now that the fact that it's working perfectly, it's got plenty of storage, it's fast enough, and I haven't dropped it or damaged it. It's still in perfect shape. means that let's see if we can wait another year for something better to come along. So yeah, it's so hard to impress us anymore, because I think everything you can do with the hardware that solves a problem of mobile phones has pretty much been done, and now it's a case of refinement. So until Apple and Google and Samsung and Microsoft and everybody else come up with a new use for mobile that renders our current phones inadequate, and it's so good that I wouldn't want to be without it, I think that it is going to be a problem of getting people to buy new phones. I probably have to start making phones with certain water-soluble components of it just to make sure the damn things wear out.
Well, I think that a lot of them, I think folks are thinking about whether phones are going to be the future anyway. So, I mean, when we talk about wearables, I probably spend more time, I'm starting to get to, I don't spend more time looking at my watch, but I spend more time conscious of it than I was before, and, you know, kind of managing things through it. And of course, we're going to have AR glasses in the next 2 or 3 years from a variety of, there's people already releasing them, but there'll be more of those. And so the question is really, you know, how much more, I think our screen time is also going on the phones is going to reduce as some of the wearables start to become a little bit more transparent.
Yeah, I think this hit me a couple of years ago when I said, God, I don't want to buy any more phones. And Lisa said, you have to, because you have to review them. And so I, you know, perforce, we get the new phones. But honestly, there's not a lot of reason to get a new phone. My mom, who has a 6S, as I said, just got a new battery from Apple. You know, that deal runs out at the end of the year for $39. I keep saying, and she, I would give her a new phone. She says, no, this has a headphone jack. I love my iPhone 6S. And now that she has a new battery, there's no reason for her to upgrade. So yeah, it's become that kind of market.
A lot of my friends are like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's that kind of moment where these incremental changes that phone companies are making, you know, like a slightly better camera, or even if you go from something like the iPhone 8 to the iPhone 10, which had a bigger display on a smaller phone, the guts of the device, it doesn't change enough for most people to say, I want to spend $1,000 to get this new version. They're just happy with what they have. You know, in some cases, it's even an issue, just like you're saying, your mom's phone has the headphone jack.
Yeah.
For some people, it's even like a desire to
backwards.
Not move forward into that technology. I already have headphones that use a headphone jack. I already have, you know, lightning support. I don't have any, you know, Qi wireless support stuff. So I'm going to stick with the phone that works this way instead of works that way. So yeah, these are all sort of pointing in the direction of, you know, at some point it's sort of a saturated market, and there's only a certain portion of us who want the new phone every year or even every 2 years. Most people want the phone that works best, and they want that phone to last as long as they possibly can. They don't want to spend money on new products every year. They want the one they have to last until, you know, 25 years from now, until there's no such thing as smartphones. So we're kind of at that point now, I think, where it's just there's not as many people who want to do that upgrade, that they want to stick with what they've got instead of getting something new every time.
The other thing that Jake Swearingen in his New York Magazine Intelligencer article points out is that we're hitting commoditization, where a product is cars hit this, TVs hit this. He uses TVs as a good example. You know, many years ago, you'd say, oh, I want a Sony Vega because that is a better TV. But at some point, all TVs were effectively the same. And that allowed for companies like Vizio and the Chinese companies like TCL and Hisense to suddenly take over, because people bought by price. They said there's no reason to. And the same thing's starting to happen with phones. There are all these commodity phones, especially in China. Chinese brands like Xiaomi, Oppo, Vivo, Transsion, huge in Southeast Asia, Latin America, India, Africa, because the more expensive phones, and this is killing Samsung and Apple. I mean, this is a really big challenge for them. Samsung's response is to create crazy phones like the foldable phone they'll be selling next year. Apple's response is to raise the price so the unit sales, even if they're flat or dropping, don't impact the overall revenue. But that can't go on much longer. Apple has a good lock-in system, though. You know, when I look at what Android does with its messaging, you know, Google just can't figure out how to do messaging. Apple's got it with messages. What?
It's
because desktop, you know, you can use it on a Mac, you can use it on an iPhone, you can use it on an iPad. It works everywhere. It's got lots of rich features. It doesn't, you know, it turns into an SMS when you're going to the outside world. You know, suddenly those are green bubbles. Somebody said at the, on Twit on Sunday, and I thought this was interesting. I thought I'd pose this to you. If Apple were to make a version of Messages that worked on Android, wouldn't they just own the world? What are they only not doing it to keep the lock-in into the Mac
no,
ecosystem?
I think they're not doing it because they just don't want to deal with it. I mean, I don't think it's a lock-in. I mean, they might be trying to lock in. That might be one of the things. But I think that Apple generally, when they do things that aren't cross-platform, I think that they have less to do with locking you in and more to do with the simplicity of programming, that they control the entire environment. I mean, that's the whole advantage that Apple has, is that they control the hardware and the software. And why would they
iTunes on Windows is the perfect example. Apple Music on Android is a perfect. They just don't work that well.
So I think that I don't think it's as nefarious as people always make it out to be. I think it's just we have a limited amount of programming and we don't like working on other people's platforms. So why bother? Right. You know, we don't need to. So why bother?
I think the big deal is that if Apple had a product or service that they felt as though they could extend and make more successful by reaching out to Android users, I think they'd do it. If they had a goal for Apple Pay to make it like on the level of PayPal, where it's just the standard that everybody's going to use to move money from one place to another, they would want to have a version of Messages so that they could have so that people could PayPal each other money, Apple Pay each other money, no matter what kind of phones they had. But they just don't have that kind of ambition. And as Alex says, it's really, really expensive to support multiple platforms. It's such a pain in the butt. It's hard enough just to add one feature to an app that's already on your platform. To support an app that's one step out of date, that's on your own platform. Imagine creating a new version of Messages for Android, given how much trouble that Messages at least causes me on iOS, where undelivered messages and confusion about how I move from one phone to another, and now my new phone is not getting this stuff. So, if Apple found I don't think Apple has a really good reason or a really good motivation to do it, and they're not going to do it just to say that, hey, look, look how far our influence is, look how far our reach is.
Well, and the penetration for the new operating system is what, 75% on the Apple, and it's just completely fragmented on Android, and so it's not just supporting another platform, it's supporting 10 other platforms to make it all work. I learned a lot about this when we built an app called Conduit. It's now Pixel Conduit, we worked on it, and there was a Windows version for about 10 seconds. We built one and released it, and it's just you're now supporting 25 platforms, that we had to make sure that it worked on, whereas on the Mac, we didn't have to do that. And it was a really important lesson for me on not making it more complex, because we weren't getting significantly more sales. We were just getting a lot more, a lot more customer support.
Yeah, it's nice to be in Apple's position where you're making so much money that a right. business opportunity like that, you could just have the discipline, and there's where Apple really excels, to say, we could do it. We could make more money, but we're not going to. We're going to have some discipline here and focus. Stick to our knitting. It's really the users that want it, to be honest with you, because Google just can't seem to figure out its messaging platform. I would use iMessages everywhere if I could.
You always, I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of Mac users who have lots of Mac, Apple using friends, when you see the green bubble, you're just like, you feel like your wings have been clipped in this conversation.
Bubble land.
It gets so much worse when you have a friend who actually still doesn't have a smartphone, which I have a friend who doesn't have a smartphone. It's those conversations are awful when you have to do group threads, and there's one person, when they respond, it looks like it's only going to you. So yeah, I know what you mean. It's when you have everybody in the same ecosystem chatting with each other, it really does help. I think everything that everyone said makes so much sense, that, Apple doesn't need to, what's the point? There are other sort of chat mechanisms that we could use they don't have to be Google, they don't have to be Apple. But because those are what we consider to be our text messaging apps, they're not our chat apps, they're our text messaging apps in our brains. We don't think about the fact that we could go to like a completely different program like Snapchat or even Facebook Messages if we wanted to do our chat conversations with people. And the idea that Apple being able to or being willing to put messaging on Android, it seems like it would be like the perfect solution, but it also would be so difficult and time consuming and not worth their effort to go across.
Yeah. They've got good discipline. It's kind of impressive. Rest of us would be leaping at the few extra bucks it would make us. It's like, wow, we can own everything. Let's take a break. We're going to talk about trade war because it is heating up and it is absolutely going to affect the iPhone and Apple in just a little bit. Is there any Mac news that we can share? I guess all I would say is I am looking at that Mac Mini more and more as the best yep. Mac ever. I love my MacBook Air, and I was concerned about speed, but battery life and usability, no touch bar, the form factor, I am using it all the time. I have, an i9 MacBook Pro, but that MacBook Air is the sweet spot, at least for me and the way I use it. If I'm going to use Photoshop, I'll use my iMac Pro. If I need something heavy duty, I'll use the iMac Pro or even my MacBook Pro. But for 99% of what I do, that MacBook Air is so nice and more than fast enough. And I have to say that Mac Mini is starting to look a little superannuated with – I mean, the iMac Pro is looking a little superannuated with that Mac Mini. And the eGPU, I'll pair those up, and that's a pretty sweet – that's a pretty sweet platform. And I could finally get that super wide 34-inch curved screen I've always wanted. Yeah.
I was looking at the exact same thing saying that. No, a Mac, I would much rather have a mini and like a crazy stupid looking screen. And they're really, really good. From my point of view, it's like, oh, how stupid is that? Until, wow, I've got a use case for it now. And that seems like that would be a fun thing to sit down to every morning and stare at for 10 hours a day.
These I know if people are aware of these. This is like this Samsung CF791. These are 34 inches. And the thing is, essentially, I have that setup, but it's three monitors with bezels. So it essentially would eliminate the bezels. The problem is I have an iMac, and so there's, you know, I can't do that, but you sure could do it with, look at these. They're silly looking, aren't they? But and they're not expensive. They're less than the LG Ultrafine.
So I'm someone who doesn't have Mac Mini. I know what it is. I know what it does. But from my perspective, it's sort of a hobbyist computer. So tell me, as a computer user, what's the point? And this is somebody who is all in on Apple. So you get that I'm definitely one of the average consumers when it comes to Mac Mini and what it does and what the point of it is.
So we haven't gotten any of the new ones just yet, but we're probably getting pretty close. We've got about 30 of the older Mac Minis and of different everything from 2012 to early to newer ones. And we use them for glue everywhere. So they're typically the form factor that we use them for is rack mounted into a variety of different kits. You know, I don't know how many people really have them sitting on their desk, but the little Sonnet rack mounts are, we have them everywhere. And we use them for, again, glue. I need scopes. I need some extra information. I need to manage logins. I need to, you know, we don't depend on them that heavily, you know, for anything graphics heavy, because the graphics processors are horrible. And but outside of that, they have been, you know, probably one of the most used computers that we have, because we can just kind of put them everywhere and then pipe them into whatever else we're doing. And I think that's a way a lot of professionals are using them. I don't know if they're really a heavy consumer.
Well, but to answer Lori's, you know, hobbyist thing, no. If you put a 6-core i7 in there, which you can, and you add the eGPU, which gives it credible graphics performance, especially if you use you know, one of the third-party eGPUs, which can really have a real graphics card in there, that's as fast as an iMac, probably as fast as iMac Pro, considerably less, and it gives you the option of, this is the one I want, the Samsung 49-inch monitor. So if
I don't think I have a table in my house that could fit that.
Well, and Leo, and one of the things I'm looking at doing is
three of those side by side by side for 180 degrees.
You could go all the way around. I have three monitors, but again, the bezels screw it up. If it would be the same amount of screen real estate in one monitor, that's awesome.
Well, yeah, and one of the things I'm looking at is I have a room that I keep, you know, it's a little server room, and what I've been looking at doing is getting my hard drives, my Mac Mini, everything all over there, which is, you know, maybe 50 feet from my office, and then just running the monitor and the keyboards in to my office, and then just separating all of this. It's nice and quiet, and it's got, you know, and I just have my screen, and that's it. You know, and so you can also simplify a lot of things. And I mean, that's a lot of how we use it in the office. So you can mix and match.
You're not stuck with the, as good as the iMac screen is, you're not stuck with that 27-inch screen. You can do other things.
That's how I would answer the question. That it's, I'm kind of, after all these years, I've sort of come all the way around 360 back to where I started.
Modular.
Well, I like, it's now, it's very, very useful for me to have a desktop computer that when I need a different screen, I can swap, or who knows, in 2 years from now, I might be doing a lot of video and I might want three monitors to set it up with. Or now it's just a simple like writing machine, but now I really want it to be like the hub of like an office network, and I want to have a couple of RAIDs like slung off of it. And I feel like I'll be able to keep using it for years and years and years and years. Whereas my normal mode has been, I can't afford to spend $7,000 on multiple computers. So I'm going to buy a really, really good notebook. And when I need to plug it into another monitor, I'll plug it into a monitor, but I'll be unplugging it at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's probably what I should do, is use that MacBook Pro instead of getting an iMac. Look at, this is why I want this monitor. Look at, this is 16:9. Now watch when you go to the 49-inch ultra-wide monitor.
Look how much more productive you're being with that machine gun.
Do you play a lot of Call of Duty?
It doesn't matter what you're doing, although I have to say gaming would be pretty amazing on this.
It's really streamlining your aerial combat workflow.
Okay, maybe I want to try Fortnite on it. I admit, maybe that's the goal.
They know who they're selling these things to.
But it's more than just gaming, because I honestly, and you know, Alex knows, when you use a Final Cut, for instance, you need multiple screens so that you can have the controls on one screen, the output in another screen, the timeline in a third. And this would give you that kind of, you could have Battlefield and Final Cut running at the same time. That's what I'm talking about. Eventually, but my problem is I spent $5,000 on an iMac Pro, so I'm not likely to at any point be replacing that. Now, we're going to see a new Mac Pro, which will be also another way to do that, right? That's going to come out sometime in the next year or so. But I have a feeling the Mac Pro will be four or five times the price of a Mac Mini. So and really, most people, I don't need all the power of an iMac Pro. That was a silly purchase.
You just wanted it. You just wanted all the new things.
It's my job to review all this stuff.
It's for the listeners.
I do it for you.
But also, when you think about the professional use of, one of the things we've done with Mac Minis to some degree, and now I'm definitely looking at them for this, is rendering solutions. So, you know, you can put two of these per you,
right,
you know, into a rack. So you can get 10 of them or 15 of them, and then you're sending out compression, you're sending out rendering, and they're relatively, you know, low power consumption and very powerful to do a variety of rendering solutions. So, and I think that I really think that Apple is, when they rolled these out, is really thinking about professionals and how they're going to use them, because a lot of people have been using them, in between all the other things. Because the Mac Pro is not, I think the Mac Pro is going to be 3U and, you know, 3U and full wide. I think that's what they're going to end up putting in there, because I think that they realize that we don't care about the little round thing. We just want to be able to put it into a rack.
Well, they better not put it in the trash can. That would be a big mistake. I hope they.
I think you have the ears removable in some, you know, Apple-y kind of good looking way that you could set it somewhere if you want. But I think that people who are pros, we want to be able to swap out or add GPUs. We want to be able to swap the other pieces out. We want it to be highly modular. We want it to be rackable. And I think that is a more likely output. Maybe not 3U. Maybe it's 1U or 2U. But I think that, you know, Apple might move more that direction. I think they went down the path of the round thing.
Yeah.
But it's just not.
Would you not welcome a cheese grater?
I still have some cheese graters.
I love the cheese graters.
I love it. Yeah, it's great.
They were so easy to add drives to. They had so much space. They were really.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's exactly. I mean, just that. I think that there's ways that you could make that, you know, even the upgrade process even easier, you know, where you can slide things out, slide things back, you know, like pull a tray out and change your card and then pull it back in. And there's lots of things that Apple could do to innovate, because we don't see a lot of innovation in the server area because people don't really care that are putting them in server farms. But I think that there is a way to make it a lot better for a lot of us. And, you know, and so I think that, but I do think that a lot of us want rack mountable solutions as opposed to ones we're going to put on our desk.
When do you think we'll be talking about the Mac Pro? Early or late 2019?
I'm going to guess late.
Late, really?
Yeah.
And
yeah, I think we would have heard a lot more musings through the rumor mills by this time.
Yeah.
If there was something coming in the first half of the year. So I think we'll see it in the last half of the year.
And that's Andy, my guess. That's my opinion. Think earlier than that, Andy?
I think announcement at WWDC and maybe they don't want to tempt fate, but all the times they've announced a new powerful Mac at WWDC and had to say, yeah, we meant this year on the Jewish calendar, not the year. But yeah, I agree with Lori. I don't think we'll see it on shelves until late in the year.
Yeah.
I think that
which is a good thing for me.
Show it off during I think
put it off as long as you can so I can rebuild my savings.
Yeah.
yikes!
Yeah, I definitely think an announcement in June and a release in November would make a lot of sense.
Yeah. Let's take a break. Our show today brought to you by the best way to buy online. I do this all the time. Privacy.com. I've been using Privacy for months. It is a virtual Visa card. And the minute you use Privacy, I love it. There's a couple of ways you can use it. What I do is I create a Privacy card per merchant. So the minute the merchant uses that card, it's locked into that merchant. I could show you the credit card number. It wouldn't matter because unless you're Verizon or Hulu or Medium or one of the many people I use credit cards for online or Amazon, you can't use it. I can also set a spending limit, which keeps people from stealing from me. I can freeze and unfreeze cards, so never again do I have to worry about an online subscription going on for too long. I love Privacy. It is so awesome. Watch how easy it is. Now, you attach Privacy to your checking account or to your debit card. So this isn't a charge card. It is immediately taken out of your checking account or your debit card. But to me, that's fine. I don't actually like to pay 19% interest on my purchases. It goes out right away, which is fine. It's 100% free to use because they make their money, as all credit cards do, from the merchant. In fact, they make so much money, they even can give you up to 5% cash back. The more you use it, the more you make. You'll also know sometimes before the merchant knows if they've been hacked, because you'll get notifications if a hacker tries to use the card elsewhere. So if I use a card, let's say, I don't know, I'll use as Amazon as an example, and suddenly I see a charge coming through from somewhere else on that same card, first of all, it'll be declined because it's locked to Amazon. But second, I'll know, somebody got the credit card from Amazon. That's amazing. I would think you would know faster than the merchant themselves that they've been hacked. You'll get a decline email or push notification or both if the hacker tries to use the card elsewhere or the card goes over the limit. I love using limits. I just set up a Verizon account for the iPhone XR, and I set a limit on it. I'm on the line with the representative, and she put the charge through. She said it was a client. I said, well, what did you charge? And it was just over the limit. I said, oh, wait a minute, hold on. I moved the slider to the right a little bit. Said, now charge it. She said, oh, I went through. She said, you have control of that now? I said, real-time control, yes. And I could turn it back down if I want. It's awesome! You want this. In fact, I told her, I'm using privacy.com. I literally said, Eugenia, you should be doing this. Anytime you're using a credit card online, especially, privacy.com. They have a Chrome plugin. You can generate cards in the browser. They have a website. It's very easy to create new credit cards. Expiration date is always 5 years out, so you don't really have to think about it or worry about it. You've got 5 years to keep using that card. But as I said, you can pause or freeze it anytime you want, so you never get a subscription that just goes on forever and ever. You just turn off the card. It also, you can use any address and zip code you want. So you get real privacy here because the merchant's not getting your real address or real zip code. Privacy.com will approve it even if, you know, they don't care. Basically, it is absolutely as secure as a real credit card. PCI DSS compliant, same security standards as your bank. They encrypt all your information using split key crypto. Partial keys are held by separate employees. I mean, they really pay attention to all of this stuff. There's a webhook API if you want, so you can access transaction data in your app. Two-factor authentication, of course I use that. Now, bad news, only available in the U.S. Sorry, Canada. Sorry to all our listeners outside the U.S. But the good news is it's 100% free to use. It costs you nothing. Privacy.com has saved customers over $100 million in unwanted and unauthorized charges due to compromised cards, hidden fees, forgotten subscriptions. Never worry about it again. Protect your privacy and your money. Virtual cards from privacy.com. I should have told Eugenia to go to privacy.com/MacBreak because she would have got $5 off her first purchase. But she was, how do you do that? Eugenia, you got to use this, privacy.com/MacBreak. All of you do. I love it so much. I tell everybody, privacy.com/MacBreak. $5, just, you know, a little thank you for using the MacBreak offer code, privacy.com/MacBreak. $5 off your first purchase. But trust me, this will save you so much money in the long run. And it's so, I feel good using it. I have dozens of privacy cards now, and they just can't be used anywhere but that one merchant. That's fantastic, and I could turn them off anytime. privacy.com/MacBreak. Let's see here. So China has, I think this has to do more with the battle back and forth with Huawei and the tariffs, but China has ruled in favor of Qualcomm's patents. This happened yesterday, and they've blocked sale and import of the iPhone 6S, 6S Plus, 7, 7 Plus, iPhone 8, 8 Plus, and iPhone 10 in China. Doesn't, I guess, impact the most recent iPhones. I'm not sure why, but this is going to be the new reality for every company that does business in China and any company that imports products from China. You know, I'm a big fan of e-bikes now. I've kind of got the e-bike religion. And I've been waiting for an e-bike from Lithium Cycles, the Super 73. They sent out a note saying, thanks to the 25% tariffs on e-bike motors imported from China, we had to move all of our manufacture offshore because we just got a shipment that would have cost us $300,000 in tariffs. So we transshipped it to Germany. And that's going to delay your bike a little bit because we now have to assemble it in Germany. These tariffs are going to impact everybody. Of course, the temperature's been ramped up because now the CFO of Huawei has been arrested. Not saying that her arrest is illegitimate. She was arrested in Canada, will be extradited to the United States. The U.S. is accusing her of breaking the Iran sanctions by creating a phony shell company selling Huawei gear. By the way, not just Huawei gear. They were selling HP gear through this shell company to Iran. So remember, we talked about back in February, the FBI saying, don't buy a Huawei smartphone. In August, the president signed a bill banning government agencies from using Huawei and ZTE equipment. You've recently seen the administration going to other countries saying, don't put Huawei gear in your 5G equipment. Again, there's clearly a legitimate case here and legitimate cause for concern since Huawei was founded by a former member of the Chinese military. Their CFO, Meng Wanzhou, is actually the daughter of the founder. So there's definitely tight connections to the Chinese government. But now there's concern that China, which is not happy about this, I'll put it this way. If I were you, Alex Lindsay, I wouldn't go to China anytime soon. And I think a lot of tech CEOs are saying, I guess I'll put that trip off.
Yeah, this could actually end up damaging the situation for China more than I think we think. I think most of the people will say that this is not the tariffs hurt the United States in many ways more than China. But I think that there is a chance that China gets damaged very badly here, because you have a lot of companies that are starting to make choices. You know, Foxconn is looking at opening up iPhone manufacturing in Vietnam. You have, you know, GoPro moving some of their manufacturing. And the thing is that once that starts to happen, it's a genie that's hard to get back in the bottle. You know, when things start to expand out, where people start deciding that China is not a safe place to do this, I think that it is, you know, the long term hit is going to be a little harder for China. I mean, obviously, Apple may take a hit they're kind of caught in the middle of all of this, and so they may take a hit as well. Huawei is taking a huge hit. I mean, I think that there is so much concern about the security protocols related to China. I think that China really looked at 5G as something they're going to expand all over the world using Huawei technology, and now country after country is starting to shut them out for security concerns, which are probably valid.
Canadian telecoms are removing Huawei gear from their 5G installations. It's going to cost them at least $1 billion. Yep. BCE, TELUS, Rogers all use Huawei equipment. Huawei is the number one manufacturer of 5G gear in the world. They're the number two phone manufacturer. And I'm not saying there isn't a real cause. I mean, there's two problems. One, spying. They could, you know, Huawei gear could be used to spy on American companies for industrial espionage. And also the real threat of cyber warfare. They could, you know, maybe there's a kill switch built in. They could throw a kill switch and take our networks off the air. I don't know if there's evidence of that, though. This is the problem. There's a political component to this, and there's a real security component to it. And I don't know how much of one or the other is in play.
There have been concerns expressed for quite some time.
Yes.
This isn't the Huawei.
Back to the Obama era. Yes,
so
absolutely.
It's not a Trump thing. It is a government.
Yeah.
You know, concerned about it, that they've found information that worries them.
Yeah. It's really, really difficult when you have basically a state-run country as China is, which is not to say that there are companies in the United States that would not do underhanded things at the behest of our government. But the thing is, they really are. There's a stage at which a company in America can say no, saying we're just not going to be part of that. If they want to do that in China, there is a limit to how much they can push back before they can continue. They have to decide, do we want to absolutely be ended as a business, or do we want to do exactly as our government tells us to do?
What I honestly fear more is just a heightening of tensions between the two countries. When countries trade together, there's a natural tendency towards good relations. When they're not trading together, when people silo, that leads you to less good relations and ultimately war. And yeah, so I think there's a larger concern here about than purely economic. And, you know, it's getting hot. There are Chinese companies at this point that are telling their employees, don't use iPhones, use Huawei phones in solidarity. It's getting hot. And, of course, as I just mentioned, China is now blocking all but the most recent iPhones from import.
Yeah. But that's the weird thing. It seems as though this isn't a bearded socialist talking. Once you lose the support of wealthy people in your country that think that they will no longer be wealthy if this plan keeps going forward, that's when revolution happens, or that's when factions start to get lots and lots and lots of support. We might see interesting things happening in the next 5 or 10 years as people who are the first generation of the first generations of inherited wealth, who feel as though they are entitled to their status, are suddenly looking at the government as not people who enable and engage us and give us these opportunities, but as people who are going to try to take away our wealth from us and take away our power from us. And again, that's when you start to see if there is no democracy, that's when democracy starts to creep in. And if there is democracy, that is when you start to see the opposite of democracy creep in.
I don't see much trend of democracy creeping in anywhere in the world at this point. It seems to be going the opposite direction. And again, if you're not kind of in bed with another country, then there's always the risk that you will be at war with another country. And that's really, to me, I think that's a bigger concern than any economic concern.
As Winston Churchill said, talk is always better than war.
Yeah.
He's a jaw, but
yeah. Rocket 88 in the chat room said, when trade stops crossing borders, soldiers soon do. Apple bought a company called Bedit. Now they've released their new Bedit 3.5-inch or 3.5. I don't know which it is. I guess it's 3.5 sleep monitor. Bedit makes a monitor that goes in the mattress or under the mattress. And the new 3.5 version is available at the Apple Store. $150, a little expensive. Goes under the mattress, and it will work with the Apple Watch. People have wondered why the Apple Watch doesn't have sleep monitoring. Well, this is how Apple's going to do it. They own Bedit, and it actually makes sense because, you know, I mean, how many people want to wear a watch to bed? You got to charge it sometime. Well, if you got a monitor in the bed, it automatically goes to the watch, and that's nice. This is expensive, though, compared to the Serta sleep monitor, which I use, which is now under $60. And I'm not sure if this is better or not. It measures how much time you spend snoring, sleep time, bedtime, time to fall asleep, time awake, time away from bed, wake up time, sleep efficiency, heart rate measurements, average, latest, I'm sorry, highest, lowest, average breathing rate. It has a force sensor, capacitive touch, a humidity sensor, and a temperature sensor.
Is that a pee sensor or is that a humidity sensor? Can you clarify?
It's a strap like this that you put under the bed. Now, I have the Serta sleep monitors, which are little paddles we put under the pillow. You can have two, one for each person if you're a couple. And then I also wear this Aura ring, which I really like, and I can check my sleep through that. But this is another way to do it. You'll see a heart rate curve, resting heart rate, average breathing rate. I think the snoring thing is interesting. I know it must, detect vibrations?
Yeah, I don't know.
Total duration of snoring? That's something I would like to know. When I snore, I would like to know it. So,
but this is I think, more exciting to me than the ECG monitor on the Apple Watch.
I agree. This affects more people, doesn't it?
Not only that, but there's so much data that you can get from how much time is somebody spending in bed just for that. And also, how well are they sleeping? And it's not just the numbers. It's also, this person used to be sleeping roughly 5 to 8 hours a night, 7 days a week. Now they're sleeping 2 hours at a time, or now they are in bed for whatever reason, 12 or 13 hours a day. Does this mean depression? Does that mean that they're having trouble keeping their balance and they'd much rather stay in bed? Are they feeling sick? There's so much data that once you connect it to all this other data that can be collected and analyzed, that it really does paint a much more perfect picture of someone's overall health.
Yeah. This is the Aura ring told me that I went to bed last night at 10:15. I woke up at 8:04. Total bedtime then 9 minutes, 48.9 seconds. Resting heart rate, 58 minutes. Sleep efficiency, 71. It took me 13 minutes to fall asleep. I had a very small amount of deep sleep. That's the most important one, 16 minutes. 4 hours of REM sleep, though. I was dreaming, baby. Woke up a lot, though, 11 wake-ups. That kind of stuff is interesting. And one of the things this Aura ring measures that neither Bedit nor the Serta measure is your temperature. And temperature is apparently very important, too. So yeah. I like this Aura ring because I can wear a ring to bed. I can't wear a watch to bed. But I also compare it to the Serta results. The Serta results are pretty similar. That's an interesting comparison, you know. It's called Sleep Tracker. Let me see if I have the Sleep Tracker on here. Oh, I guess I don't. I have it. Oh, I know where it is. It's on my Android device. Too many phones, too much information. Sometimes I think knowing too much about how I know if I got a good night's sleep, I know if I'm tired. That's all I really need to know, right?
Yeah,
and there's probably a lot of people out there who suffer from some sort of sleep deprivation of some kind. And
who doesn't?
Being able to, well, not me. I get a great night's sleep most of the time. I'm very lucky. But if you find yourself sluggish all the time and you don't realize maybe that you aren't sleeping well, being able to kind of find that out without having to go to a doctor. Although I'm saying the same things about the sleep monitor that I was saying about an ECG monitor, which I understand that whether or not you sleep isn't as dangerous as whether or not you're having a heart attack. But
yes.
It's the same idea, which is that it's not bad to be able to kind of just find out what your health is, what you're doing, what your body's doing when you sleep. And even like my mom, she now uses sleeping mask. I can't remember the name of it. The kind that gives you, CPAP. It helps you breathe. The CPAP. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. But she didn't know that she wasn't sleeping well. And she just was like sluggish and just cranky. And physically she felt just kind of like she hurt a lot.
Sleep apnea is actually life-threatening. That actually is something that needs to be treated. So
And that was something that after months of talking with doctors, they finally decided to do a sleep study with her. But if, you know, this is a circumstance under which you could probably find out, at least you could know early on, like I'm not getting any sleep. Maybe I should go to my doctor right away and tell them specifically, I may not be getting enough sleep.
Don't you know from being, just because I'm exhausted, that you're not getting enough sleep?
Well, like I said with my mom, she didn't know that's what it was. She didn't know that she wasn't sleeping through the night. She just couldn't figure out why she was tired all the time. She thought, I go to bed at, 9 and wake up at 7 or whatever her sleep schedule is, and didn't realize that she actually wasn't sleeping through the night, that she would just wake up at, 150 times a night or something like that. She didn't know she was waking up. It was just kind of happening.
This is the 50th anniversary of the first demo of a mouse, of menus, of windowing. Doug Engelbart, then a mid-career 43-year-old engineer at the Stanford Research Institute, gave the mother of all demos, December 9th, 1968. If you've never seen his 90-minute long video, it's well worth seeing. He demonstrates basically all the technologies we now take for granted. He said, if you, in your office, as an intellectual worker, were supplied with a computer display. Remember, this is in the day when you didn't have a computer display. Backed up by a computer that was alive for you all day and was instantly responsive to every action you had. How much value would you derive from that? Well, I think we know the answer to that now. Pretty amazing.
I think the more impressive part about this particular article is the fact that he was inspired by, I'm looking for the date. It was like 1945.
Vannevar Bush's As We Might Think, or as, yes.
Yeah.
This was an amazing essay that presaged everything that we've seen. He was the director of the Office of Scientific Research and Development. Yeah, this is a very, very famous piece. If you haven't read it, you'll get chills when you read it. Like, this guy knew.
And it just puts it into perspective just how important technology really is to us in our minds. We don't know that it's important to us until we already have it, or if we don't have it. But we've been thinking about it since before we had technology, since we were just using telephones and radios and things like that. It's amazing that in such a short period of time in the general lifetime of humanity, that we jumped from not even having televisions to having the kind of technology that we have in our pockets. And seeing articles that go all the way back to 1945, which to me seems so long ago, that they were already contemplating this level of technology in our near future.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah. This is why the only way to predict the future is inadvertently and by making the most ridiculous, absolutely inapplicable assumptions. Let's say that I'm going to give you 90 minutes to give a talk, and I'm going to tell you that imagine that it's 10 years, 20 years from now, and we have the ability to make transparent steel. Go. And then you think, well, of course, that's impossible. But if we had transparent steel, that means that we could basically make light conductors that are structural. That means that we could make it would also be conductive, which means that we could have an electrically conductive and a light conductive material, which means that. And then, well, what do you know? You didn't foresee, you thought that was theoretical that it would be able to do this. But then 20 years later, someone can actually do this. And it's because every futurist 30 or 40 years ago would talk about how look how smaller a microprocessor is going to get while doubling its power, while missing the idea of what if the breakthrough comes in battery technology, the fact that we don't have to plug things into an outlet anymore because we have tiny, tiny batteries that can power a computer as powerful as that for an entire day and make it practical. So yeah, the entire demo is online. The entire paper is online. And after years of hearing about it and people writing about it and actually seeing it, oh boy, was that a big payoff. It really does deliver.
I was lucky. Engelbart died about 5 years ago, but I was lucky enough to interview him on the old Screensavers show. And he brought the wooden mouse prototype that he used in this demo. And it was such an honor to meet this guy who was really such a forward thinker. And this demo, again, if you haven't seen it, 50 years ago, presaged everything. There he is that we use today, including a mouse, a cursor.
Yep.
It's just incredible.
And a pretty cool-looking mic.
Yeah. The mic is more modern, to be honest.
You want the NASA mic. If you can get – I don't care about Bluetooth. I don't care about the near-field communications. I just want the NASA mic.
Yeah. Really, really cool. Fun to watch this from 1969. This is a very big story, and I think very important. We've been debating back and forth over that Bloomberg story about Supermicro. The audit is complete, including servers supplied to Apple. No spy chips found. Reuters reports that Supermicro today advised its customers of the result of a third-party audit. They told customers today an outside investigations firm had found no evidence of any malicious hardware in its current or older model motherboards. So, I mean, we've been waiting for the other shoe to drop on this story, and it happened just a couple hours ago.
Yep.
Nardello and Company, a global firm, tested samples of motherboards in current production versions that were sold to not only Apple, but Amazon as well. That was were the ones that prompted the Bloomberg story. It also examined software and design files without finding any unauthorized components or signals being sent out.
Yeah, you kind of knew that was going to be the result when you realized that in the couple of weeks after this news broke, nobody else had anything corroborative or supportive that they were able to report after it. And it's not just the idea that, hey, well, gosh, this is news to us. Let's grab one of these motherboards and have one of our forensics guys, one of our forensics people take a look at it to find it. It really is. It shakes out of the tree a lot of other stories that a reporter might have picked up on but didn't see the significance of at the time, or a conversation that now seems to be important in retrospect, and nobody had anything after that. So that's that. The next phase of this is, where did you get this story from? How did Bloomberg okay it for publication?
And why didn't they retract once all these other organizations were...
I think they're just trying to skip the cycle. You know, they're just hoping that there's enough other news that's going to come up that they can just kind of step over it and skip the cycle. But these articles are going to keep coming out until they retract. You know, this is an article. We're finishing our report on one that I bought in 2015.
Oh, you actually are analyzing your Elemental.
We tore it apart. Yeah, we tore it apart. So we're going to be posting something. And, you know, they're going to keep on getting more and more data. And the thing is that Bloomberg just wants this to go away. It is incredible. It was potentially very damaging to Supermicro. I mean, this is the kind of thing that could end a company, you know. And so for them to be as loose as they were with the data and have everything, I mean, this is a good example. Everybody anonymous. I get that it was important that no one knew. But, I mean, you're putting yourself in all kinds of danger when no one wants to put their name on it, you know. And I think that it was sloppy reporting. And these guys have had issues in the past. I think that it damages the Bloomberg brand. And I think that they were just trying to, they're trying to sidestep it. I think they just think it'll go away, and it's just not going to go away. I think at some point you're going to see Apple and Amazon and other press them again. They have to, you know, figure this out. And I think that we have to think about whether those reporters should be doing this again.
Well, Reuters story, they quote Supermicro saying the company is reviewing its legal options.
Yeah.
Bloomberg probably has really good insurance, but it might have limitations to the sort of due diligence that Bloomberg is expected to perform before going with the story in order to get the payout. So I'm going to follow this story because it's going to be an interesting tale of exactly how far a publication can stick its neck out without and still feel as though it's okay for us to move forward, because what's the worst that can possibly happen to us? And I think we're going to find out the worst that could possibly happen to Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm. And the danger is not going to be the actual findings of the lawsuit. The dangers for Bloomberg are going to be this, the discovery and the depositions and the emails and the, you know, where, you know, did they try to cover this up? Did they, you know, try to slow it down? Where do they, you know, the, all of that stuff, all that investigation is going to be incredibly damaging for them. And it's going to draw out over years when they, all they, what they needed to do was when they realized they were in trouble, they needed to back away.
Exactly. This is such a trust thing. Like the, especially news organizations, they rely on the trust of their readers. And when something comes to light that might not have been right, even if you're not ready to retract or say that we were wrong, making a statement that, you know, we have reason to believe that we don't have the exact correct information, we're going to do some research and follow up with it. And Bloomberg just kind of remained silent in that, which I think is the biggest danger to their reputation, is that now that we see what they did with this news article, what are they going to do in future articles when it comes to light that the information may not be right? And we can't even trust anymore now if somebody is to accuse them of not having correct information, because we see under this circumstance specifically that when they were accused of not having correct information, they did nothing. So it's a very, very dangerous situation for Bloomberg to be in right now with their reputation.
Well, I think it's going to be hard for them to have any big blockbuster breakthrough scandal that they could cover again for quite some time, because everything is going to be going through this filter.
But even if it's not a scandal, even if it's just literally, you know, some company just says Bloomberg lied about, you know, what they saw, even though they have pictures of it when I was walking down the street. Now their reputation is at stake, and therefore, like, that calls into question everything that they report on.
I just don't get it. I mean, they worked on this for more than a year. They had, you know, internal oversight. I don't understand how it happened. And I hope that they would step forward and say, well, here's what happened. They need to do a postmortem and they need to make it public.
Yeah.
Here's what happened. Here's how it happened. Here's why we believed it was good to go with this story. It is
they're not,
unbelievable because they are a legitimate. I mean, they're highly respected.
I was going to say, at this level, one of the things is that people want to dismiss what reporting is all about. The thing is, internally, you have to fight. Part of the process at this level is you have to fight your own editors, and your editors have to fight their own chiefs, saying that prove to me that this is right. Prove to me that you've got it. And you think you got it locked, and you do have it locked, but someone upstairs is going to say, yeah, but what about this piece of information? You need to find another source to back you up on this, or you need to find somebody who will go on the record on part of this. And that's part of the challenge that gets the story tighter and tighter and tighter and harder to refute. So that's why it really is baffling to me that a story can be this wrong and get through the process. That means that there is a process that has failed immediately and catastrophically at Bloomberg.
Yeah. I think we haven't heard the whole story yet. There's something else. And I can't imagine what it is.
Yeah, this isn't an opinion columnist. This was a news story.
Yeah. All accounts, they'd been working on for more than a year and had a strong oversight from their editor-in-chief, who's highly respected, came from The Economist. And it's a respected publication. How did this happen? And, you know, I don't know if there's a grounds for a lawsuit. That's a complicated thing to do because of the First Amendment. But nevertheless, we deserve a little more information about this, not silence. Yeah.
And the other thing is probably whatever agreement that those writers signed. I don't know if there's staff on Bloomberg. They are staff. So they probably, as part of the contract, they said there's a clause that on the contracts that I've signed. It says, by the way, you assert that you're not making any of this stuff up. And if you turns out that you did make up something that you put in an article that ran on a publication, we're done with you. Yeah. You get to fight the loss. Our defense is going to be that this reporter lied to us and you will not get the $1 billion defense. You will get the public defender, your cousin who usually does real estate law.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things we don't know is, in all fairness to the reporters, is that we don't know that they
may have been fed a story.
Exactly. They could have been fed and designed a story by a group of people for whatever reason. I mean, this could be stock manipulation. This could be just people wanting to create a story. you know, and being imaginative. I mean, because it's definitely like, hey, this is what's happening, and you can talk to, I know a guy over there, and I know another person over here, and they start talking to them. That's how you end up with 17 people that won't go on the record, is they might all be connected to each other to some degree and all talking about it. And so we don't know. I mean, I'm not saying that that's what happened, but I'm saying that we don't know what happened with those reporters, other than they just really needed to have more actual data. They needed an actual board. They needed people actually, you know, on the record reporting on it, or they shouldn't have made such a big deal about it. I mean, they were on everything, you know, when they released this. And that's part of it. It just got way bigger than I think anybody expected.
I can't wait to hear Bloomberg's response. Yeah, I hope there is one. Let's take a break. Your picks of the week coming up. But first, a word from LastPass. My pick, if you've got a password, you've got many passwords, who doesn't? You need a password vault that's encrypted, secure, that will help you create long, strong, unique passwords for every site, every app. That's LastPass. I've been using it for a decade, and it's the best. Steve Gibson, our security guy, actually talked to the creator, looked at the source code, gave it his thumbs up. He uses LastPass. We use it at the enterprise version, because, well, if you think about it, as a company, you're giving passwords to your employees. You're giving them the keys to the kingdom, the login to your bank account, your servers, your data. LastPass protects all of that. Data breaches happen. You cannot wait to get password security locked in. Make every employee on your team a part of your security solution with LastPass Enterprise. Does a few things your employees will appreciate from a convenience point of view. It makes password sharing easy, but it keeps access to corporate data secure. Every employee has his or her own secure vault for managing and accessing passwords. LastPass Enterprise offers you centralized admin oversight. You can set over 100 policies, including master password requirements for the employees. You can enable password resets. I get an email every time Russell does a password reset because one of our employees has forgotten their passwords. We require them to use two-factor. You can do that, too. If an employee leaves the company, you can restrict access as well. You get actionable security reports, shared folders. That's a nice feature. All the ops people have their folder. The business department has its folder. So the passwords they need are available to them, but no one else. And we trust it so much, we put everything in LastPass. Database logins, SSH keys, software licenses, business information. I use LastPass at home, too. I put my passport, my driver's license, my social security numbers, everything. Even things like my most important numbers, my frequent flyer numbers. They're all in LastPass. It's convenient, too, because I have those numbers whenever I need them, but no one else can see them because LastPass data is encrypted and decrypted only at the device level. Data stored in the vault is kept secret even from LastPass. And it works everywhere you do. Android, iOS, Macintosh, Windows, Linux. There's a LastPass Chrome plugin. There's a Safari plugin. There's an Edge plugin. It is the easiest way to create and remember and fill in passwords for any use. And I tell you, with iOS 12 and now the new ability to fill in passwords, it's even easier. It's the first app I put on a new iPhone. Because it will help me set up all the rest of the apps. I love it. No more copying and pasting from the LastPass app. Same thing on Android. It's just really sweet. More than 16 million people trust LastPass. It's the number one most preferred password manager. And you need it for your business as much as they need it for their homes. In fact, that's one of the things we offer all of our employees. Because we use LastPass Enterprise, we also give them a personal account. Yes. And what's nice is they can keep both accounts with the same login. If they use Microsoft Active Directory, it's even simpler. Then you can just log in with your Active Directory credentials, but it's still secure. LastPass Premium for personal use. LastPass Families, that's what I use at home. It makes it easy to share passwords with my entire family. Their emergency access means I can designate somebody who gets access to my vault if anything should happen to me. That's really good. LastPass Teams, if you have a small team, 50 or fewer, and of course, LastPass Enterprise for a big organization. It's affordable, it's effective, it's secure. It is absolutely a must in business. Take control of your business passwords, reduce the threat of breach. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit. LastPass.com/twit. Lori Gill, do Do you want to pick a rock and roll song? Do you want to pick a scary movie? Your picks are always interesting.
I like that you've caught on to my scary movie trend.
Did you see the new Suspiria? I haven't seen it.
Oh, don't break my heart. I haven't had a chance to see it. It's not available in theaters anymore, so now I have to watch it on a boring old small home screen. But
it's coming out on Blu-ray DVD.
Yeah.
January 29th.
It was just bad timing that I missed it in theaters. It was a bummer. And it wasn't playing in Sacramento where I live either, so I would have had to drive to San Francisco to see it, which isn't that far, but I didn't make any trips to San Francisco during that time.
It was an Amazon studio production. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, which is weird. I purposefully won't let anybody tell me what they thought of the movie because I don't want any judgments coming at me. I want to be very fresh when I go in and see
it. Does it help to know that music was scored by Radiohead's Thom Yorke?
It hurts. Because Goblin scored the original soundtrack, which I did actually go see Goblin scoring the soundtrack to Suspiria live
right
before the movie came out, and it was beautiful. So I'm certainly, unless Goblin is scoring the remake, of course I don't think it's good enough.
So I think I should see the trilogy, the original, and then I can see the new one.
Honestly, I don't know, because I don't know what the new one is like. I don't know whether or not it's capturing the original story or if it's taking a different route. So I can't recommend to you one over the other, but I can definitely recommend to you watching the original Mother of Tears trilogy, because it's amazing.
I gotta see them all.
And beautiful and weird.
That was your last pick. What do you got this time?
Well, this time is something much less interesting, but I just went to the absolute depth of my laziness on Sunday and just did not want to go grocery shopping at all. But we were out of food. I needed to go grocery shopping. So I signed up for Instacart and it was wonderful. So my pick is actually Instacart, because I couldn't believe how easy it was to have all of my groceries. I picked them right
on
the website.
It's available in Petaluma.
It's available in a lot of places, and a lot of grocery stores support it. So my grocery store that I normally go to was right out there on the list. And for anybody who's wondering, you don't only get to pick from brand names. You can pick store brand, which is, I buy a lot of store brand stuff because it's less expensive. You're not paying more to get it. It's the same price. You can use coupons. You can use the sales that are happening in that store live. You get all of that. I believe you pay somewhere around $10 per delivery. It's like a $5 delivery fee and a $5 service fee within that price range. And then they do recommend that you tip the person who's buying your groceries for you, because they literally, there's like a person who goes into the store and does my grocery shopping for me, delivers it to me. The woman who delivered to me, her name was Leslie, and she was the nicest woman. I actually signed up for express delivery. It was a free 14-day trial. This just happened on Sunday, so I've only done this once and loved the experience. But I think I'm going to end up keeping the express delivery, which is $99 a year, because honestly, $99 a year is worth me not having to go to the grocery store every week. I also don't own a car, so if I need to run to the store for something, it's a big ordeal. I have to ride my bike or call for a Lyft or Uber or take the bus. It's not just a hop, skip, and a jump down there. So this is, for me, it's even more beneficial for just the ability to get stuff from the store when I don't have easy access and transportation down there. So thank you, Instacart.
So in our area, Safeway, Whole Foods, Costco, Smart and Final, CVS, Petco, Smart Food Service, BevMo, Sur La Table. I mean, it does everything. This is awesome.
I felt so bougie doing it, but I was so happy with the results.
Sometimes bougie's not that bad.
It's just that issue of like, I don't have time to go to the store. I don't have the time to make dinner, so I go out to eat a lot. I'm one of those people.
No, you got it. That's bougie. You got to start cooking.
Well, now that I get my groceries delivered, maybe I will cook more often.
I made Wiener Schnitzel last night. That's a popular request. Our 16-year-old, don't tell him, because I used to make pork chops, breaded pork chops, and he wouldn't eat them. So I've pounded them flat, and I said, it's Wiener Schnitzel. Now he eats it.
Nice.
It's actually quite good. I like
it to sounds
put,
really good.
Yeah, I like to put tomato sauce and mozzarella on them, and then it's Parmigiana.
Nice.
It's fun to cook. But you're right. It's a pain. That's why we use Blue Apron. It's a pain to like go out and shop and then plan it and then cook and all that. This is nice. Instacart. Alex Lindsay, somebody in the chat room is saying, could you tell us once again what flannels you recommend?
What flannels? What flannels I recommend?
Did you ever recommend flannels?
I don't remember.
He said, I need to know Alex's flannels, or maybe it was Andy. Justin Crash says, can Alex share his pick for best flannel again? I can't find the episode where he shared his favorite flannel. I want to get one for the cold weather.
The one that I wear probably more often, I don't wear them on the show that often, but the one I wear the most is a Lindsay plaid. So it might be that. There's a Lindsay plaid. It's very Christmassy. It's red and green. And so, especially around the season, nice. I tend to wear them. L.L. Bean makes them seasonally. So sometimes they're available. I don't think this year they're available. So as a Lindsay, you're always like, not this year. They kept Stuart. You know, so
I don't honestly know if you can get the Lindsay plaid at Duluth Trading Company, but that's my choice for flannel. I'm a big Duluth Trading Company guy. I get all my underwear. I love Duluth Trading Company. And
I also use there's some microfiber ones that are made by Eddie Bauer that I wear because they're kind of thick and they never ever wrinkle. It seems to be impossible to wrinkle. So when I travel on planes, they turn out to be great because they're thick and they're synthetic so that they wash easily and they don't smell a lot, and you can wear them especially when you're traveling 20 or 30 hours. So that's the other one that I use anyway. That's my recommendation for flannels. I don't remember when I talked about flannels before.
I don't either. Maybe he's hallucinating. I don't know.
I wear them a lot.
When you were watching the show earlier, did it look like I had lights on or anything like that?
There you go.
You know, I think that we're so close to turning Twit into a lifestyle brand.
We are almost there. Right? It is. We got mattresses. We got routers. We got password managers. Get some flannels.
Let's take a look at the 2019 Alex collection.
I love that idea. What is your pick of the week? So, by the way, I want to thank you because I don't know if you saw my gift guide earlier on iOS Today, but I did throw in that Sound Devices USB Mix Pre 3. Love that thing. That is awesome.
Pretty nifty, isn't it?
Love it. $650. It's just a little tiny bit short of a full Alex, but it's awesome.
But it is amazing. It's an amazing little box.
I love it.
My recommendation is actually not nearly as expensive. It's an app called Tintype. I don't know where I saw it, but I downloaded it. I just have so much fun with it.
Oh, it's so good. I love it. Yeah.
It's so great. It's a dollar. And I think I posted a picture on Instagram right before the show
Oh, look.
There I am right before the show.
During the Civil War, Alex Lindsay was famous for podcasting.
Doesn't it look like that? So it's a really fun app as far as the filters work out really well. So if you really need that if you want to spend a dollar so you can have that wanted poster look, this has been the easiest way to create the wanted poster look, and I've found that it's provided a lot of entertainment for my
show
kids.
Show that one again, Karsten. The battle has been raging all day in the distance.
Yeah.
I am unable to ascertain whether anything has been gained or not. Oh, how I long for this war to end. We need a little Civil War music going on. A little fiddle in the background. How I will hail the day when I return to the bosom of my... There, we got the pan and scan. That's good. It's going the wrong direction, but okay.
There we go.
Our bandwidth is down to 2G edge speed.
But yeah, it is utilizing.
Whether my message gets to you, Marjoram, I do not dare know. Know that the last text message I sent to you was heart emoji, crying face.
Anyway. What was it? Oh, yeah, Tintype. That's the Hipstamatic, folks. Tintype.
Yeah. It's a fun app for a buck. It's a lot of enjoyment.
Andy and Otko, pick of the week.
Closure on my 3-week adventure of having the SSD and my 2015 MacBook Pro die on me. I did finally replace it, and I didn't want to talk about it until I knew that it actually worked. Apple used a standard but not really standard SSD module for storage in the 2013 to 2015 MacBooks. So it was technically not some it was standard enough that they could buy the connectors in bulk, not so standard that it is possible to simply go out and buy a replacement module and stick it in. The standard right now are M.2 SSD modules. And so I bought a Samsung 970 EVO 512 gigabyte, basically a direct replacement for the size that I had in there before. This was a module that was released in 2018. So the controller is brand new. This memory style is brand new. It's super, super fast. It's wonderful. And to get it to work inside your MacBook, all you need is this dubiously, really sketchy looking, but it's just as simple as that $10 little adapter that you snap onto the end of this M2 module that will just basically switch out the pins and give you the correct sort of connector. And the 970 Evo is shorter than the original module. So it's not as though you're going to have to sort of squeeze this thing in. I just literally snapped this thing onto the end of the new Samsung module, stuck it into the connector inside inside my MacBook. The tie down screw that keeps it from shifting out lined up perfectly. Absolutely no problem. Bob's your uncle. And the adapter is like $10, and you can get it pretty much anywhere. I got both my stuff on Amazon. The module was $120. I think the adapter was like $10 or $12. So easily under $140, and imagine how much it would cost to actually take this in to Apple and get it repaired. And that shows you how much how interested I am in taking really good care of this 2015 MacBook Pro, because it is repairable and it's
still good. Yeah, totally.
All you need is to take a stop down to iFixit. It will give you the teardown guide, which is easy as pie. And also, they'll sell you the P5 Pentalobe screwdriver you need to get out before you can put in replace the proprietary SSD. You need to get at the proprietary screws holding the case together.
I got the from Otherworld Computing their kit, which includes the screwdriver, and it's a Mercury. Although some people have said the Mercuries are not that good as SSDs, but that's my upgrade for the 2015. And I was very happy with that. It really did.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just glad that I decided not to upgrade it to a terabyte, because I think I would just get myself in trouble. Yep. Also, you put a terabyte in a thing, then now you've got a terabyte you need to back up, and also I would just run out of space by not backing things up and not taking things off when I don't need
it. These are the last few that you can do that to. I don't think you can do it to the new ones.
Exactly. Everything else is soldered directly onto the motherboard. So and remember that it wasn't just, hey, wow, I've run out of space. I think I want to electively swap in a higher capacity SSD. It's no, my MacBook was dead. You cannot boot it because the whatever section of the SSD had the mounting and boot code had died and perished. And so it was just not only that, but even booting it off of an external SSD, which is what I'd been doing for the past couple of weeks, was not working out because, as we saw during the middle of last week's show, I had the most malicious, horrible Godzilla-style crash right in the middle. But again, I have this going for the past 4 or 5 days. It's working perfectly fine. Sleep works fine. Deep sleep works fine. That was sometimes an issue with other volumes before this, before Apple, I think it was before 10.13 or something, before Apple basically made the operating system support all these modes on different kinds of internal drives. So it'll work out great, and it'll keep your MacBook alive for another couple of years, and $130, easy peasy.
Andy, I was following your updates on Twitter live as you were posting them about this replacement. I was watching the Game Awards and would pop back into Twitter, and I'd see something that you pop up, and I'd go back and watch the awards, and I'd pop back into Twitter and see another thing that you posted. And it was like I was watching you actually, like, is it going to work? Is it going to work? And then the screen where you show, it did it. It worked. It was like, yay. I was so happy for you. It was great.
I have to admit, as I admitted later on in the Twitter feed, I did just weasel out. I only started posting those pictures after I rebooted it and made sure everything worked fine. Because I don't, you do the
but
research.
For me, it felt right. new.
It was, I'm glad I had you all along with me on the journey. Because I wanted to make sure people knew that it really is that simple. It's not the horror show of a modern MacBook where you have to attack something with a heat gun to separate the glue that's holding everything together, and you will definitely destroy something and you'll have to replace it just to get the motherboard. It's easy peasy. You take off screws in the back, you remove the back, you unplug the battery just for safety, and then you just unplug one module, plug in a new one, you're good. Bob's your uncle.
I am not. As you know, I had a bad Kickstarter habit for a long time.
I think we all have.
I've kicked it, except that now I'm back for one thing, and it's only because I've bought things from these company before. Sanho, I bought way back when the MacBook came out. They made a very nice dock for the MacBook that just plugged into the Type-C port and added a bunch of nice functional ports. When I got the new MacBook Pro with the dual Type-C, I got their special dual site. The brand of these is HyperDrive, and they are back on Kickstarter with a new one that just went up yesterday. It's already raised $304,000 with a month to go. The first USB-C hub for the iPad Pro. And as you can kind of see, it is designed a little differently than I can use these. This is the one I got for the MacBook, but this one's a little different because, first of all, it's centered as it should be, and it matches the color. It's really ugly for me to use a gold hub on a slate MacBook Pro. But what's nice is this adds HDMI, USB-C for power, and if you want micro SD and SD card reader, type A USB, and yes, there's an audio jack. Oh my God. And if you hurry, and I think this is really only going to be for people watching live, you can get it for half off what they will sell it for, which is $100, $49, but there's 102 left of those. So now the good news is I think there's more of the more expensive $69. Eventually they plan to charge $100 for it. I got two, one for me and one for Lisa. I am a big fan of the iPad Pro, and I've used HyperDrive dongles, as you can see, for my MacBook and my MacBook Pro, and I really think that this is a company that knows what they're doing. And this will be a nice addition. Instead of carrying a bunch of Apple-provided dongles and so forth, by using this HyperDrive, you'll be able to add to the capability of your iPad. It works with the case on, has a little bracket to steady it, and boy, that's a lot of additional functionality with one little doohickey. And at $49, that's really a good price. So hurry, as you listen to this, go to Kickstarter, search for, I think the search term would be HyperDrive for iPad Pro 2018. This would be a good thing to pick up. The first HyperDrive, this is my third, this will be my fourth. The first one I got, the USB-C connector did get loose and wobbled, and eventually they stopped working. That was one for a MacBook. But I think they've gotten better. They've, you know, this is, I don't know how many products they've offered now. Quite a few, 8 different products. This is their 8th product on Kickstarter. So I think they're a pretty reliable company. HyperDrive for the iPad Pro. That's my pick. And they got funded within a day. So I think they'll be making it. I like the idea a lot.
It's almost as if people want to have ports and functionality on $1,000.
What a thought. This will not all of a sudden make it possible for you to access external storage or anything like that till Apple adds a driver, but it'll let you read cards and do all that stuff.
But that looks so amazing. Just the ability, just the knowledge that if I take this one thing with me, the number of times where I've had to head out to an Apple store because I took almost enough dongles with me for everything I needed to do, but I did. Turns out I do need HDMI. Darn it.
Yep. This is very handy. I love it that they put a headphone jack on it. That's really a reason to get it. There's your headphone jack right there.
The only thing make it better is if they designed it like to look like a frog design, like design component, just to put that thumb in the eye of like Apple designers and say, this is the old Apple when we didn't design things to be functional.
Sigh.
Sorry.
Sigh. I'm in that mood today. Ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of this fabulous radio program. Lori Gill, rock and roll star, and just completely incidentally, managing editor at imore.com, at Appholic on the Twitter. Great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Happy holidays.
You too.
Are you going anywhere for the holidays? Doing anything fun?
Family is in town, so it's nice. Just going to be, you know, just a quick drive.
And I told Karsten, get you on more, and if you ever come to the Bay Area, let us know so we can have you in studio, because I'd like to meet you.
I need to make that happen for sure.
Someday.
Yeah.
Maybe we could set up some lights, get some amps, have a show.
I can rock out for you.
I would love to see you sing. Are you playing anywhere soon?
I'm playing on the 22nd locally.
Sacramento.
It's so small that it's just it's a house show, which is typical for punk rockers. So
I think house shows are the best kind.
I completely agree.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess people could go to your website or something and figure that out.
Yeah.
We'll leave it to them as an exercise for the reader.
Ask a punk, I think, is what the address is.
They'll know, man. Mr. Andy Anatko, you see him or hear him regularly on Boston Public Radio, WGBH, and, of course, every week on this show. And you could read his stuff on his website, new and improved, ihnatko.com.
I finally fixed my database problem so I can actually start posting to it again.
Can I just say, get WordPress.com. You won't have to worry about it.
I have WordPress.com for a side
it's
project.
It's tempting,
hopefully
isn't it?
Hopefully I can show off. It's you pay somebody to take responsibilities off your hands, and they know better than you.
No
they spend
more
time on it
problems.
Than you are. And you don't wind up having your blog down for about a couple of months because because every time you tried to fix it, you ran into some sort of wall that you just didn't have the courage or the time or the patience to get across.
Oh, I've been there a million times. I used to do self-hosted WordPress. I completely know. I know what it's all about, baby. Mr. Alex Lindsay, rock on. Pixelcore.com, at Alex, LINDSAY on the Twitter. And I want to talk to you later in the day. We have much to discuss.
Sounds good. Mr.
Lindsay, just a personal message. But one of them involves December 23rd and a bottle of Louis XIII cognac.
Did you find it?
I did find it.
Oh.
We do have it. And we will have lead glass, specially designed, very expensive glasses, cognac glasses to drink it out of. So that was his incentive.
I didn't think you were really going to do it.
Of course I was.
I was going to come no matter what.
I told you. If you do the show with me, we will have Louis XIII.
Can I come to that show too?
Yeah. Lori, do you like cognac?
Oh, it looks so delicious in specially designed lead glasses. That's a win.
Lori, this is a $3,000 bottle of cognac.
My gosh.
This cognac.
I am no longer bougie. It's you guys that are
I'm unapologetically bougie. This is made.
So great.
This is 100 years. The people who make this cognac never get to taste the final product. They it takes them 100 years to make.
That's insane.
Yes. Yes.
Can I send you like a Tupperware shot glass?
No.
No.
You have to come out, Andy. You have to come out.
But Lori, seriously, Karsten will call you if you want to come down for I had to incent people because it's our holiday twit on a Sunday. It's the eve of Christmas.
It's right before Christmas Eve. Yeah.
It's December 23rd.
I don't know. It sounds really awesome.
Got these glasses that are specially designed so you can warm the cognac in your hand and as you swirl it around.
And it's an excuse not to be with the family.
You don't need to be with the family. Just us, your family on the air. And while John Slanina will not let us do cigars in the studio, we could, I don't know, maybe we'll have...
You gotta dip the cigar.
See?
See, John? Taste on your mouth.
I'm telling you, I'm willing to do the cigars too. What's your favorite cigar, Alex?
I actually have some Cuban ones at the house.
Okay, will you bring me a couple of Cubans? We can
let me see if I can find them. They're little ones. They're like cigar.
That's perfect. So your cigarillos. I like a Maduro, But we will get cigars if cigars are desired. And just to see Lori with a cognac in her one hand and a cigar in the other would be worth the price of admission, I'm telling you.
I think that might be fun.
Okay, folks, if you're going to have the really expensive cognac and the Cuban cigar and the crystal snifter, you're going to have to get like the smoking jacket and the ascot.
Oh, I have the smoking jacket and ascot. I am absolutely wearing my smoking jacket and ascot.
All right. I can provide you with a smoking jacket.
I have a smoking jacket here.
Okay. I have two. I need to get an ascot.
The ascot can be any scarf.
You keep a spare. I like that you keep a spare smoking jacket. That's nice.
Of course.
Yeah. All right, Leo, you bring the smoking jacket. I'll be ready for it.
And any silk scarf will do as an ascot. I mean, if you want to do it right, go to Hermes. But any silk scarf will do.
I'll see if I can find my Cuban cigars. They're packed away somewhere, so I'm gonna.
Oh, I don't want stale Cuban cigars. Come on,
well,
they
could be stale. They've been around, so they were given to me, and then I of course set them down, and I was like, I know.
I haven't smoked a cigar.
Here's
in
the
years.
Problem: is you get cigars, and then you want to say if they're good cigars, you want to save them for the right time, and then you. Save them.
That's right.
The right time is never comes.
Never comes.
Exactly.
And then, they're not smokable.
And I go.
I'm just thinking. I don't know where to go with this, but I'm thinking maybe a Davidoff Short Perfecto, something like that.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking.
Yeah.
We don't want a big. Yeah. John's going crazy, by the way. John is just dying.
Just get a filter. You got a filter in there, don't you? Just filter it.
How about this? From Nicaragua, the Illusion Epernay.
Yeah.
It's from the Champagne region, so it's perfect to go with a champagne-based cognac. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yep. This is completely off topic.
Why do we not have our own lifestyle brand? Why?
I know.
Thank you so much, Lori Gill, Alex Lindsay, Andy Anatko. Thank you all for being here. We do this show every Tuesday right after iOS Today, around 11 a.m. Pacific. That's 2 p.m. Eastern. That's 1900 UTC. You can watch live at twit.tv/live. There's a live audio and a live video stream. You pick the one you want, but if you're doing that, you really ought to be in the chat room, irc.twit.tv, where all the cool kids who are watching the show live are hanging out. You can also be in studio. I mean, that's super cool. In fact, now I think we're going to get a whole bunch of people interested in coming in on the 23rd. Email tickets at twit.tv. Yeah, we'll have a studio audience that day. I can't promise you all. Maybe I'll give you a sip. I can't promise you all a snifter of brandy, but you can have a sip. You can have a sip of mine.
Leo might deign to allow you to touch the hem of his robe.
We'd love to have a big studio audience for our special holiday twit. That's Sunday the 23rd. You just email tickets at twit.tv. We'll give you all the information you need. On-demand versions of this show, every show we do, always available at our website, twit.tv. In this case, twit.tv/MBW. You can also subscribe in your favorite podcast application. That way you'll get it automatically the minute it's available every single Tuesday. It's Pocket Casts, Overcast, Stitcher, Slacker, Apple's Podcast, Google's Podcast, whatever you use. It's all there. You know, it's one of the longest running shows in podcasting. So, of course, they've got it there. Make sure you subscribe. That way you'll get it every time. Thank you for being here, and we'll see you next time. But now I'm sad to say it's... time to get back to work because break time is over. Bye-bye.